Welcome to the airport lounge. Table for two gentlemen? Right this way. Here's your booth. Have a great show.
Welcome to the Airport Lounge, the Winnipeg Jets podcast, and sweet fancy Moses, I can't do a traditional opening because we just swept McJesus in the first round. Vaughn Mitchell, how's it going? Woo!
Wow. Are we trapped in a Paul Rudd meme again? Look at us. Who would thought we would sweep the Oilers? Not me.
Look at us. Hey, look at us. Look at us. Huh? Who would have thought? Not me.
Or maybe Kobe White? Maybe Kobe White at the 2019 NBA draft?
Oh, it's an esoteric poll. Good for you.
Wow. Wow. Wow, bro. That's crazy.
We're back. In somewhat of an elated and jubilant mood. I still can't believe it. It's the day after the 3 overtime win by the Winnipeg Jets, and we're here to break it down and heap some praise, some well-deserved praise on just about every aspect of the organization, and that coming from me is saying something.
I think it's well-deserved. It was a really fun weekend. I think I saw Hustler on social media today say that, you know, with everything that's going on and people not being able to get out it like they usually could or go to the lake and do whatever, that it's going to go down as one of the kind of epic May-long weekends of all time. We had 3 games, all of which were wins. We'll talk about each. We'll talk about the series collectively. We'll talk about each game, and each one of them has. It was a journey in its own way, just excited. So what are your initial thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, I have to say, and we'll start it off with a bit of an anecdote. Following our first episode where we described in detail the folly, which is still sitting in my shelf, Anchipop jersey, I had thought about tweeting out that I would get a Nate Thompson jersey, the off-maligned Nate Thompson, if the Jets swept, knowing, or at least at the time, knowing full well that probably wasn't even a faint possibility. And then when we won game 3, I texted Vaughn and some buddies, and I was like, I'm kind of glad I didn't do that, because we might do this. I'm in disbelief, and I think the biggest part of it is, and we can break it down a little further, but there were so many aspects of the Jets game defensively and positionally that I really hadn't seen for any extended period of time over the regular season that all just seemed to click into place. And I was obviously under the misguided belief that you needed to show extended periods of really solid defensive and, intelligent play in order to put all that together in the span of 4 games. But like, clearly I was mistaken. And I like by game 3, I had surpassed sort of cautiously optimistic to very optimistic, because we were just beating them. I mean, we'll get into the advanced stats, and we still didn't come out favorably in that area. But I just the eye test, like that we were doing things against Connor McDavid, and we were getting the goaltending we referenced in the previous episode, where I was like, all we got to do is keep this up, and we're gonna win, and we did.
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised. But I'm not shocked. I'm slightly shocked it was 4 games. Obviously, no, let's be honest. Yeah. We're shocked that it was shocked that it's a sweep. Yeah. But we did talk about, if the Jets' goaltending, which hadn't showed up all year against the Oilers, decided to show up. And we were in agreement. And I was, I would say, borderline emphatic that if we got good goaltending, that it's not going to be close. We're going to, I said, take it in 6. I can't sit here and say I ever imagined 4 games or even 5 games. But I was quite confident that if we got the level of goaltending that, you know, we played to the potential that our elite goaltending, Connor Hellebuyck, can provide, that it wasn't going to be close. And that's what happened. Hellebuyck faced 159 shots over 3 games. He made 151 saves and had a 9.49 save percentage.
Yeah.
He, according to Evolving Hockey, he had an impressive 6.6 cumulative goals saved above expected goals. So he saved
6.6
shots that should have gone in the net over four games. Okay. No, you know, because three of those four games went into overtime, that's a defining difference. Although the tenor of the narrative today on social media is that the Oilers simply got goalied, I agree with your opening comments, Mike. I don't think that was the case. I don't. I think there was a series of things the Jets did very well, and I'm really looking forward to talking about them.
Yes, and I agree. To your point, if you know, again, the advanced stat, the expected goals, the higher danger chances in all of the four games, those favored Edmonton. But I thought in order to win the series, we needed to, A, obviously, make sure that we contained Connor McDavid. And in games one and two especially, I thought we did a fantastic job. And then at the end, Paul Maurice was matching lines.
Yeah.
Hallelujah.
Yeah.
Which, again, full credit to him. And then I thought what we didn't discuss in any great detail, what really became apparent, obviously, in games three and four with the OT games, was the Oilers' lack of depth. Because we had indicated in our last one that overall, in totality, we're a better team. But once you see a team over and over again like that, and especially you're going into OTs and Nurse is playing 50 minutes, and they basically don't have a... They don't have a third, second, or fourth line, right?
Yeah.
And it became, and they have one defensive pair, and it became apparent. I was like, okay, I get it. No, we are a better and more well-constructed team. And coaching, whatever you'd call it, there wasn't any part of any game where I was like, maybe game two for a bit, where I was like, ooh, this could go bad. But all in all, at all times, I was like, we've got this. We've figured this out.
You can do it!
Yeah, I think I agree. As we've discussed at length on this podcast, the Jets needed to change their defensive approach against the Oilers, and they did. And it was successful. You know, while they didn't end up shadowing McDavid or hard line matching against him overall, they did at times, especially in the fourth game. I thought you saw a lot more of Lowry out there head to head. Their overall defensive awareness and attentiveness were exactly the things we've talked about in our previous podcasts, right? Like, okay, you're out there against McDavid, you know, let's for the most part, there were times where, yeah, daddy might have been yelling at the TV and scared his children because they weren't paying enough attention to where McDavid was on the ice. You know, the other thing, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, and probably this podcast will have less structure than the other one. So please forgive us if we're all over the place. But, you know, one of the things building on that point is you have to just listen. If we're going to sit here and say Paul Maurice isn't doing this and Paul Maurice isn't doing that, and then he should be doing this and he should be doing that. And then if we put it on the line and we say these things need to happen, you know, in order for the Jets to win, and they do, well, that's good for us because we're not wrong. But the coach actually did them, right?
Yep.
And we suggest things at 30,000 feet, and he made them happen at ice level. So you know what? Just like Paul Maurice gets the blame when tactics don't work, he should receive credit. Not all of the credit, but credit when they do.
100%.
Whether your narrative likes it or not. Now, I think he gets... listen, it's a game played and won by players. Coaches can lose games, players win games. So the majority of the credit goes to the Jets players for sure.
Yeah.
But there was obviously some plan put in place, and the Jets players executed it. So Paul Maurice and his coaching staff gets to take credit, and I would like to acknowledge it.
Yep. 100%.
And the only downside to this means we're looking at another 3 to 5 years of Paul Maurice.
You read my mind. So I echo your sentiments 100% because, again, and I'm more guilty of it than you, I think, sometimes. I'm very hard on him. But I, at the end of the third overtime there, that was one of my first thoughts, was like, we did it, and Maurice deserves props. Now, you go on social media, and the Twitter stands are all out there, because, you know, he's got a small contingent or army of fans that were really quick to be like, where are all the Maurice haters now? And I do not, and you alluded to it, I do not take back a single thing that I said.
Not one thing.
Because I think we were right and justified in our comments, and you put it nicely. He made some moves. Again, we're not gurus by any stretch of the imagination, but I thought he made some very practical and realistic changes to the lineup and to the structure that worked, and so he gets credit for that. And I do agree, though, that all those hoping that this season would be the demise of Paul Maurice had better put that in a rainy day fund, because he's not going anywhere.
No. And I think the thing is, I don't want Paul Maurice gone because I don't like Paul Maurice. I figured that in my amateur assessment that he was a barrier to the Jets moving forward in a way I wanted them to see forward.
Yeah.
Move forward. We'll see how the next round goes. To be honest, and again, we're probably, you know, this podcast will not have a lot of structure. We'll jump around a lot. I think we're at the point now we can say the season, although not done, and there's more work to do, it's been a success, right? Mm-hmm. I think we need to be careful about setting impossible standards to measure success. The Jets need to win the Stanley Cup. Listen, if the Jets win the Stanley Cup in my lifetime, it will be unexpected.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think almost every market in a team that's now going to have 32 teams, right? You don't just get to win it once every 32 years, right?
It's not straight statistical algorithm. Yeah.
Yeah. In a salary cap era, it is astronomically improbable. Like, even though one team wins it every year, it is highly difficult to win if you haven't won it before.
Even if you have the best team, that's the problem.
Even if
right?
you have the best team, it's a tournament. It's not the best team is the number one team after 82 games. That's the best team, and then you go to this tournament, and the tournament winner isn't always the best team. So, I mean, it's fun. It's fun. We're jumping around. We're all over the place.
How's that working for you, by the way? Your robot brain. Let me know if you're going to self-combust here without the lack of structure.
Mike, we're not following my notes. This is not good for me.
Does not compute. Does not compute. Does not compute.
I should. If I knew we were going to be this,
vampy
focus, I would have had a drink before. You know? All I have is a glass of water beside me, and my brain is slowly
impaired. Okay, if we're issuing mea culpas, I would like to really quick, again, because you have to be fair where fairness is required. And in terms of, again, not fantastic throughout the series, but Mr. Pullman, Mr. Forbert,
yeah,
kudos. Again, were they spectacular? In some instances, they were. Pullman had some really, like, I'm not just talking about his goal. Like, him and Stanley together, that was a revelation. Well done. Again, Paul Maurice, well done. They were a great third D pairing. And Forbort is just not my cup of tea. But yeah. He had a great stick and prevented a number of break-ins and, quite honestly, was a bit of a thorn in McDavid's side to a lesser degree than other Jets. But I also, kudos to you gentlemen, because, you know, again, I've been hard on you all season, but when it counts and when it mattered, you performed well. So tip of my hat to you.
Nice. I got two quick things before we move to the game by game. I just want to mention that I don't think the Jets should apologize for having an elite goalie. You know, narrative was that the Jets, you know, it was mostly Hellebuck that was responsible for the Jets advancing. I don't buy that. But even if it were true, you know, it's like saying, well, the only reason the Oilers are any good is because of McDavid. You know, almost every team that goes deep into the playoff every year It's because of great goaltending.
Yeah.
We have an elite goalie. He's a player, just like McDavid. Everyone has their role. We got goals from our top line, our second line, our third line. Our second power play unit suddenly became the first power play unit.
Yeah.
Not because the first one necessarily sucked, but the second one was doing well. So there's been lots of areas where the Jets were decent to good over and above the goaltending. But, I mean, he's a player. And he's a member of our team. He gets paid like the other guys on our team. And he played really well. And I don't think that that should take away from the, you know, the success that the Jets were able to have. We swept them in four games. If he plays a little bit worse, we still take that series.
I agree.
Back to your point about depth. And lastly, I want to do a quick shout out before we move on. I want to shout out to my friend and football coach and colleague, Jeff Reddy, who just celebrated his seventh wedding anniversary. Congratulations, Jeff.
Wow.
Jeff is always keen to retweet the link to our podcast, and I think he even listens once in a while, which admittedly is difficult for him as he's an Oilers fan. But it's nice to see an Oilers fan that is gainfully employed and not in jail. Well, I think he's not in jail. He spends a lot of time for someone who supposedly isn't incarcerated. He spends a lot of time in a jail. He says he's a prison guard. Let's hope that's true. Thanks for listening, Jeff.
Oh, that's awesome. And to be an Oilers fan and listen, also awesome. Yeah. Thanks,
he
Jeff.
He tweeted me a picture of all his Oilers jerseys before the start of the series. He said, with which one should I wear tonight? So I didn't have I was so angry I didn't have a witty retort. Other than, you know, boom, here we are.
All right, let's check in time. Yeah, all I do is win, no matter what. Okay, the first game was, the first period, I couldn't quite figure out what we were doing and whether I liked it or didn't like it, because as you alluded to, we weren't really shadowing McDavid, but we were really tight defensively, and then we got outplayed, I think, in parts of second and third, and McDavid started to heat up, but Hellebuck was great, and then we got some bottom line goals and a Pullman goal, and we won, and I was in shock, and then I was like, are we going to win this?
Yeah.
At the end of it, I was like, I think we might win this, because if we needed one of those, right? We needed one game where it was like pretty clear that, and the whole of it, that we'd been outplayed to a certain degree, at least in my opinion, and we still won, and I was like, oh my goodness, I think we might win.
Yeah, you know, for me, right from the opening faceoff, it was on. And here's why. We talked a lot about line matching and all that. So who does Paul Maurice put out there? 55, 26, and 81.
Yeah.
And what immediately happens, Dave Tippett matches that with the McDavid line. Now, that's a tactical move in the sense that you want to see, you want to get Tippett to declare his intentions. So now you know Tippett wants to match McDavid against Scheifele based on the year. Now, just so everyone knows, the road team must identify their starting lineup first, and then the home team, which was Edmonton, gets to match. So yeah. I thought it was funny that we had mentioned that, you know, Paul Maurice would troll Winnipeg social media by starting Scheifele, and he did. So I thought it was
you called it
kind of funny. And Mike, I got to ask you, how do we win a game where both Dominik Toninato and Christian Vesalainen were in the lineup? How do we win that game?
I don't know. So first of all, thank you for pronouncing his name, because I had it written down here. And it's like, I'm not even doing this. I don't have my notes, and I'm like, I'm not even going to say his name, because I'm just going to butcher it. So thank you for that. And quite honestly, when PLD and Ehlers were out for game one, I had just mentally, I checked out. I was like, all right, well, we'll take a beat down in this one, and hopefully one or both of those guys will be back for game two. So this was the start of a series of really improbable and, you know, happenstances that obviously turned out in our favor. But I had the exact same reaction. I was like, did we just win with those guys? I think we did. Yeah. Which is crazy.
Well, I think you hit the nail on. You picked the perfect word to describe this game: improbable, right? So let's start with the Pullman goal. You know, first of all, Pullman scores a goal. Not going to happen.
We're done. That analysis is done.
Exactly. But that can happen in any number of ways. But it happens when he's driving the net.
I know.
On you know, first of all, what's he doing there?
I don't know.
I don't hate it, but that's not something we've seen. up to that point, nor did we see it in the rest of the game. So he just made this unilateral decision to jump up and drive the net. Like, good for him. But it's not something we saw before that, like I said, and it's not something we saw after. So I'm glad that they scored, because he might have got, well, I mean, as we've seen, it's going to, the only thing that benches Tucker Pullman is an injury. But, you know, on the Tony Natta goal, speaking again of improbable, I originally didn't see it go in. And I have to admit, I kind of like the surprise elation of the buzzer going off to indicate a goal as the play continues. It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
It's kind of a unique thing. And you could hear it, but I don't know. I haven't mentioned this to you, Mike, but go back and check out that goal. And if you listen closely, you can hear the Jets bench screaming at the ref that the puck went in.
I did hear, because I rewound it at the time, because I record all of them, and I was like, because it seemed to me that everyone on the ice, and especially on the Jets bench, knew it went in, except for Stanley. He was completely caught off guard, but everyone seemed to realize it. And quite honestly, at the announcing crew, they picked up on it too.
Yeah.
And I, you know, again, I'm always bit a glass half empty. But I was like, are they going to stop this? Because I'm pretty sure that went in. And sure enough, yeah. But you're absolutely right. The bench knew it.
Yeah, it was fun in the sense that you're kind of like, is it in? I think it is. And it's just that little sense of, mystery for a second there. So it's good in the sense that when it happens for your team, then it's kind of a fun thing. And sort of, you know, when it happens against your team, it's like you're getting punched in the face for 30 seconds. But because you know it's coming. But no, that was, improbable. So we have a goal by Tucker Pullman. We have a goal by Tony Natta. And then that, you know, the empty net opens up and Wheeler and Connor love some empty net goals.
They showed up.
Oh, boy. They love some empty net goals. So I don't think that Mike Smith was actually on the bench before Kyle Connor had scored. That's how quickly they had pounced on that empty net. So, you know, but overall, it wasn't a beautiful performance.
No, it wasn't a masterpiece.
It was what I took away from it. It was a marked improvement from what we saw during the regular season. In no way, shape, or form do you watch that game and think, we're on the road to sweep these guys. Like, you're thinking it's a marked improvement. They've made adjustments. We might be in this series, which part of us didn't think we would be. Mm-hmm. We thought if something needed to change in order for there to be change, and you saw the start of that evolution in this game. So I was left hopeful. And I was heartened by the effort, process, and of course the outcome.
Yeah, game two.
IPA eye test Friday
night. Oh, there it is.
IPA eye test Friday night hockey. So everything I say.
Playoff hockey.
Everything I say might be off a little bit. Because after a long week at the salt mine, I was really looking forward to a long weekend starting with an IPA eye test Friday night hockey game. So my mood was very positive going into the game, as we've discussed. And it was even better when we learned that PLD was back in the lineup. So that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
He's certainly struggling, but he's also definitely part of the group that they're the best group the Jets can put on the ice. And of course, that's what we want, right? Like, if we're going to win or lose, let's just put our best.
Yeah, fair enough. Whoa. That's a good way. Great way to say it, because we're uber positive today, but his contributions we'll get to it later.
Yeah, is there a more snake-bitten guy? Like, he's doing
unbelievable.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Can something just not fall for him? Anyways.
Other than him? Because he's on his ass all the time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. What else do you think about this game? I have a couple other things to say, but I'll let you jump in.
I wanted to shout out Lowry on the penalty kill. I know it's, good you move. Know, it's something that penalty kills is what it is, right? But I watched him closely, especially in game two, and he's a master where, you know, I think we play a little soft and a little tight, you know, our box is a little tight for my liking.
That's what she said.
But he knows when to be aggressive, and in those puck battles, he wins those puck battles. It's just, it's nice having that comfort blanket, because obviously the Oilers power play is one of the best in the NHL. And when he's out there, I feel comfortable. So I just wanted to shout that out, because I thought we outplayed them in the first, and, you know, when I wanted to shout out Stanley from this game, I thought he was good throughout, but he was really good in game two. And it was just one of those where, you know, I was watching it on my iPad in front of a campfire, and I was like, man, doesn't get any better than this.
Yeah, fair enough. What a great, great evening that must have been.
Yes.
For you. I was inside somewhere where there was indoor plumbing, and I had a fridge full of cold beer. So I was thinking the same thing. You know, my mother always said my idea of camping was a 3-star hotel. So she was right on that one.
You don't like voluntary homelessness?
Yes. No. Why would someone choose to do that? I thought in this game, no, I did like that the Jets were leading in shots after the second and third period.
Yeah.
I thought that was good because even though the first game went the way we wanted it, it also still resembled the regular season in some respects. So I felt this game, this tighter checking game was even better. I quite liked it. I may have needed it for my anxiety levels, but I enjoyed it. And I felt that, you know, this is obvious to say in what was a 0-0 game at the time, but I thought Hellebuck did a fantastic job of timely saves. Now, of course, he got a shutout. All saves are timely. I get it. But the point is, like, if they go up at, you know, 1-0 at the start of the third period, it's not the end of the world, right? But his ability to make key saves at the start or the end of a period or overtime session, I thought were, of course, overtime because it ends the game. I don't want to sound like any more of an idiot than I am. But
I know what you're saying, though, and I agree. Yeah, I do. He has a, you know, in throughout the series, he let in some questionable ones, but when it really came down to it, he like really key saves it's what could be turning points he made. And I think it was Kelly Rudy who pointed out that when we went on that run, they still had some chances there and really good chances. And now we're in game three, but he kept us in the game and made the saves that kept us from either losing momentum or allowed us to gain momentum.
Yeah, it was a super tight game, and it was one of those things where anything could have swayed it one way or the other. The game just sort of lived on the thin edge of the wedge, and, you know, I do think, I mean, it was a pivotal game, and we'll talk more about that. You know, I felt that, and I don't know if it was all the IPAs in my system at the time, but I was yelling at the TV for the Jets to back check. Like, that's what I was yelling, because
I don't know what we're yelling about!
You know, I just sort of sensed that, you know, whether it was the second or third period, and obviously in overtime because the next goal wins, but I felt that something was going to break in this game. Now, maybe I didn't understand it like that in the moment, but it was a tight game. And
were you yelling at them to shoot too?
No, I don't do that. I don't cheer after I yell True North, and I don't yell shoot. In fact, listen, we could do a whole podcast.
I know.
On fandom, the Jets power play, yeah, and fandom, and so I will admit. So that takes us to the goal. Okay, so I'll say I didn't see it immediately. You know, I was sitting there, my kids were still up. And they were jumping around, and of course I trusted everyone. My wife was there too. But I kind of didn't believe it went in, not because I'm like the Jets suck and they can't win. It's that I wasn't sure. And then we scored and then I realized that it's in and it's confirmed because people are jumping around, and man, was it off it. Awesome. You know, it was just, I have to admit, you know, the Winnipegger in me was kind of like, is this real? Is this, could this be?
Yeah. You know, could might this be punked?
Are we getting an airport now? You know, are all the good things happening? You know, and I will say this, you know, I haven't loved the way, I'm going to get his name wrong.
I could fill in. I do that all the time.
Harna Rayan Singh, the play-by-play.
Oh, guy. Yes. Yeah.
He's fine. But I don't think he's anti-Jets or anything like that. I just think he loves Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews.
I agree.
And my sense was that he really, like, he just enjoys when you know, Connor McDavid scores or Leon Draisaitl scores, and he seems to be a little bit more pumped for them. But his call on the Stastny goal was outstanding.
Unbelievable. It was
outstanding.
Yeah.
And I felt, in a way, he got better. I know we're talking about the announcer here, but he was much better from that point on in being balanced and being excited and conveying the game through his voice equally for both teams.
Yeah.
Than up to that point, because he's fine as an announcer, but I felt that he kind of had favorites, and I never felt he was anti-Winnipeg, but maybe he just loved McDavid. And then, but his call was, what did you think, Mike? Because I thought it was like, well, as we're going to talk about the Oilers goal, and as epic as that goal was, this call was epic for me.
It was. And I, at the time, I didn't really see, I'm the same as you. I didn't know, it didn't register right away that it went in, and his call was unbelievable. And, you know, now that we're in Tangent Town, like, I guess maybe we'll talk about the Bud Seltzer guy that everyone seems to be all worked up about. Yeah. That poor SOB in that suit for six periods. Anyway, he is probably the worst defender of the telecast in general, in that I do think the Hockey Night in Canada folks, like, it's palpable that, you know, we'll have a two-goal period, and they'll be showing Connor McDavid highlights from the previous game. Like, it's, again, I get it. Connor's the best player in the world. It's, you know, it's unifocused on him. But there are, again, Elliot's a professional, and he's as balanced as they get. And BX is just BXA. But there is just, and we're probably got some persecution complex being a Jets fan. It is, to my mind, is quite noticeable. And so I don't find, I did see that on Twitter that people were complaining about him. I think he's just fine. I don't think there's anything exceptional, but I do like his calls. And to sum it up, but that call with Stastny, that, you know, that made the game. I had fun with it. I was listening to it on my phone. Like, it was just great and made the experience, you know, 3 or 4% better.
Oh, I agree. I thought it was great. So yeah, that takes us to Sunday, and you know, the epic game that will go down, you know, it is hyperbole to say it was an epic game that will go down in the annals of history of the Winnipeg Jets, but it's also not hyperbole to say that, because I think it will. I think, you know, the back to game two very quickly, the Stastny goal tipped it to us. You know, there, that game was on the thin edge of the wedge, and it is now on our side. Right now we need to do something with this. We get Ehlers back in the lineup. That's exciting. The Oilers make a bunch of changes to their lineup.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
They go from a roster that was big to a smaller, more speedy lineup, which may have expedited Ehlers getting back into the lineup. So I don't know. Those shoulder injuries can be tricky things.
Yeah.
So we want to match speed with speed. So they went with speed. So we put some speed into the lineup. So, but wow, the Jets definitely got themselves into a hole early.
It
wasn't early. They did it nicely over, you know, what was it, 51 minutes of hockey?
Yep. Slow, methodical barn burn.
Yeah, they were digging their way out of the hole for 51 minutes. So there's 8.5 minutes left in the third period. They're down 4-1. Wow.
Yeah.
The comeback.
Yeah,
it was a comeback.
Unbelievable. And it was something where, you know, watching it, I had emotionally tuned out. And then when we got that power play goal, not being in the arena, it's tough to sense things that you're not actually there for. But you could just see the slope turned in the Jets' favor, right? And all of a sudden, we were peppering them. And like, when we made it 4-3, I did a run around the campsite, and then everyone thought I was crazy. And I remember sitting down and I told my wife, I was like, we're going to win. And we did. And thank you, Nick Ehlers.
Yeah, two things to that point. I agree totally. I want to single out the enthusiasm that Matthew Perreault showed after the second goal. And I think it's important.
Yeah.
Okay. To that point, again, we're 51, 52 minutes into a game. We just go from being 4-1 down to 4-2 down. There wasn't that much for the Jets to have been excited about before that. And given how late it was in the game, it probably wouldn't have been unprecedented for much more of a subdued post-goal celebration. You know, the very, you know, the glove taps or whatever. It's 4-2.
Yeah, head nod.
But I thought the post-game celebration helped inject some much-needed energy and enthusiasm into the Jets' play. And what happened afterward, exactly as you described, that enthusiasm in that moment helped shape what followed, right? So yep. He could have been, you know, glove tap, 4-2, you know, we're not going down, moral victory and all that.
Yeah.
But no, he immediately took the energy level and took it to the next level. Now, there was a little bit of time that passed before the next one goes in. The Jets go bang, 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 just like Mike Guthrie at a high school dance. But
that's coming out. I don't edit much, but that's coming
Damn
out.
It. but I have, to, but to your point, for me, after Morrissey scores that goal, I don't understand it in the moment, but after there's no doubt we're winning the game after the Morrissey goal.
Yeah.
Like it's just, it's done. It's just, they're dead men walking at that point. And, you know, there was no doubt. There may have been doubt in my mind at the time because you're in the moment, but the Jets were not losing that game after 44 scores.
No, and again, I want to call out a kudos to Maurice because he was interviewed after, and if you saw his reaction on the bench, it wasn't sort of the perfunctory, just, you know,
you're right,
silent fist pump. He was pumped up, and he, you know, the way he related to the media was like, once that happened, I knew we had a chance. And that's all we needed, and it was the break that we needed, and I thought that we were playing well enough to come back, and we did. And again, credit where credit's due. Because I, like you, I think, was like, okay, yeah, well, 4-2, that's great. 8 minutes left, we're not, you know, this isn't happening. So, you know, I just wanted to call that out, because I did notice that after the game. I was like, no, he, like, this is part of it. He believed, and he believed in his guys, and they did it.
Yeah, you know, and that can be infectious in the way that the players do take on, the players as a group, take on the character of their coach to a degree. So I've always not liked it when the stone-faced coach doesn't react after the team scores a big goal.
Yeah.
Like, if you're not enjoying that, what are you in this for? Like, what are you doing this for? Just the money? Just for control over people? I don't know. So that's one of the things I do appreciate about Paul Maurice, is he is willing to show that elation after big goals. Now, listen, if it's a Tuesday night in February and the Jets score, maybe he's not jumping up and down. But he has shown in big moments and in big games to really, you know, I think there was some fist pumping on the OT winner that I really liked. I thought that was good. It's okay to care, you know, and I think it's okay to be emotional. And I think he does a good job at key times of demonstrating that. And, you know, we talked about the call. This was another great call on the Ehlers OT winner. Again, we're going to talk about later whether this is the biggest goal in Jets 2.0 history. But there's not a ton to talk about the play itself because it was off a faceoff.
Yeah.
There was no lead up to it or anything like that. It was just an elite shot by an elite player.
A subtle toe drag, too. Like,
yes.
On the replay. It's a, you know, when you first see it, you're just like, okay, I think, you know, kind of a lucky break, right? To break free in a face-off like that. Yeah. But when you break it down, just a slight toe drag, slight hesitation that threw Smith off balance for a bit, and then top shelf, which was obviously brilliant.
I guess you can say it was eerily similar to his first goal he scored.
Yeah.
Put it in the same place.
And, yep.
And I don't know if that much thought goes into it. He has such little time to get the shot away and such a small window to put that puck into. He's probably just trying to direct it at the net as opposed to specifically choosing where it goes. But listen, I don't want to, you know, second guess his genius. Maybe that's exactly where he planned it to go and all of those great things. But it was fun again, jumping up and down with the family in the family room, and you know, again, like I said, we'll talk a little bit more later about whether it's the best goal in Jets history. But, you know, I think at that point, the Jets are up 3-0. I saw somewhere online that teams that go up 3-0 were 192-4. And, you know, so
yeah, I see you planted that seed in my mind. Thanks for that.
Yeah, we went back and forth and I said, listen, there's only a 2% chance we're going to be emotionally devastated at the end of this week. So yeah, 98% chance. So for a Winnipegger, there's a 50-50 chance.
Yeah, it's a coin flip after that. But yeah. I, you know, it curses to you because I was riding on cloud nine and then you sent that very sobering text and I was like, oh, he's right. I've got way ahead of myself. But anyway, I want to jump to game four, and I wanted to, because you are the, you're 55's greatest fan, and I had thought, and I know that I'm harder on him based on expectations, and there were points in throughout some of the games where I thought maybe the effort on some plays, a lot of stick wagging. He's very talented and he's key to the success of the Jets organization. But in game four, he was amazing. And, you know, nobody single-handedly wins anything, but I thought he was the most impactful player on the ice. He's not Connor McDavid. He doesn't do the same things Connor McDavid does, but I thought his effort level was at 125%. I know, as cliche as that sound, and he was incredible, so I wanted to call that out because, again, he's another guy that I've, you know, in the not-so-recent past have questioned in terms of his performance in bigger moments.
No, continue. Keep going.
No. I was like, I'm just going to leave. You keep going. Yeah, 20 minutes of this, please.
Man. Yeah, I'm gonna keep this on my phone and pull it out every time I need it.
No. My ringtone. That's your ringtone now, Mike.
Mike, let me tell you, in the most important games, your best players have to be your best players if you want to win.
Yeah.
And that's what we got in this game, led by the keeper of goats, Mark Scheifele.
I think I've been a goat owner for a month and a half, maybe.
Kyle Connor, he was active as well. I thought he had a good game. And Wheeler, he took a shot in the balls. So good job to all those guys.
Kudos to him. And I saw it right away, right? Everyone's like, go ahead, hit him in the hand. I'm like, no, he got that in the... and the berries and you know, I was relieved because I was like, if it's the wrist, the way he reacted, his wrist is broken, but I was like, I'm pretty sure he got that in the groin and he can shake that off. And sure enough, Wheeler's tough. And he was back. So I was actually relieved when they confirmed that it wasn't his wrist.
You know, Paul Maurice said the same thing, eh?
Oh, did he?
He was relieved when he found out it was nuts. Because he was worried it was his wrist. Okay. So back to your original point, where I was most impressed with Scheifele, and there was tons to be impressed about him in the opening three. Like, his two goals were just outstanding. They were outstanding. But I was super impressed by him in OT periods. He was out there every second shift, and for the most part, he brought energy and opportunity. Like, there were times, of course, that he looked bagged and he was,
he just stays slowly out too long, right? Like, even in double and triple overtime, he's still out for 50 second shifts or a minute and 10 minute shifts.
But I thought that there were big portions of his shifts where he brought the same energy that he had in the first period.
100%. 100%.
It was super impressive.
Yep.
And listen, on this game, back to one of the points you made earlier in the podcast, I was really optimistic going into overtime. It's because, you know, the Oilers may have the best two players, but the Jets have better talent from top to bottom. And I thought this would eventually come into play during the OT periods. So regardless of how great McGolfing is and how great this Seidel is.
Yes, well played.
They can only play so much before they run out of gas. Like, Darnell Nurse played 60 minutes over the six periods. Sooner or later, even those players will make a mistake. We were even able to get out Stanley and Pullman on a reasonably consistent basis during the OT periods. They took a shift. Like, it was very clear the Oilers were not prepared to do that with their bottom pair. We were able to do that. Yes, we put Trevor Lewis and Nate Thompson on the bench, but our fourth line winger, who's a pretty darn good one, Matthew Perreault, was able to get mixed in and be effective.
That was key.
And be energetic.
He brought energy.
He really did. You know, I wasn't super anxious in OT. I felt that the longer it went on, the more it favored us.
Yeah, I agree. And the props should be given to Nurse and McDavid and Draisaitl for just the sheer minutes they logged. And again, I'm not watching them as intently as I'm watching the Jets. But they didn't, like everyone, you have some off shifts and some tail end of your shift drags a bit. But all in all, they were keeping pace. And I was sort of getting frustrated. I was like, what? Are these guys on steroids? Like, do we need to get these guys tested? Because they're playing, like, they have four guys who are playing basically all of their minutes in a third overtime. And they're keeping up with us. And again, I think the final goal, Connor's final goal, and he was very candid, which I thought was pretty cool. He was like, yeah, I was bagged. I was way behind the play.
I didn't want to back check.
I didn't really want to back check, so I thought I'd just stick around and hopefully get the puck. And overtimes are like that, right? Like, I would like to give a 100% full credit to, the better team won in overtime. It's just situations like that where we had a guy who was probably on the ice too long, and he's an elite goal scorer, and Pionk made an incredible play on McDavid and then an incredible pass up the boards. Lots of skill there, but a bit random in terms of getting those goals. But we got three of them, and they got none of them.
Yeah, you know, initially I didn't realize the Connor goal resulted off a giveaway by McGolf Course.
I'm getting a shirt made. That's fantastic.
The other interesting part was it's the long change period, right? So you had Ethan Bear out there time, who had taken barely no ice in the overtime periods, but they put him out there. Now, you see the play go up. Like, McDavid starts to take it up the wing. And so Ethan Bear beelines it to the bench. And that opens up the lane for Connor to receive that long pass. So, you know, that was an interesting tactical element of what led to the goal by Connor. Like, all those things had to play. Like, McFirst round exit had to lose the puck. And then Ethan Bear had to vacate this space. And then Connor had to be too lazy to back check. Like, who would have thought that everything he does, that, you know, he does it all season long, but here it actually pays off for him. So, you know, it was late. I was happy that it happened on many different levels. You know, it's a little sad that in all of these fantastic, or these two overtime wins that happened at Bell MTS Place, there were no fans to see it.
That would have been incredible.
It would have been incredible, but it's still ours to, you know, ours to enjoy, ours to experience. It's a truly unique thing. In the NHL, I was reminded today that the very last game in the WHA was the Jets beating the Oilers for the AFCO Cup. So it's not unprecedented in the sense that the Jets have never beat the Oilers. The Jets have just never beat the Oilers in the NHL. So,
in the NHL. Well, that's well put. Why don't we transition and we can interweave some further commentary, but why don't we go to the pre-boarding announcements, and the lists are going to be large here, but who are you promoting into first class after the colossal sweep of the Edmonton Oilers?
One of our first class passengers would like to sing you a song inspired by one of our coach passengers. And since we let our first class passengers do pretty much whatever they want, here he is.
Well, I felt that, you know, I didn't want to get too cute by half here. I'm going to go straight forward. Connor Hellebuyck goes into first class.
Thank you. I'm glad you did that.
He's definitely the driving factor. Although I don't think it was he stole the show. Like, he's not making spectacular save after the Oilers did not get goalied. They did not. Our goalie happened to be our best player.
Yeah.
But we had good performances. We had a good game plan. We executed that game plan. And that's what it takes to win in playoff hockey. But at the end, he was our best player. So Connor Hellebuyck, take your pillow. You know, move up into first class.
Get a hot towel, some peanuts.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to go, and I had this, Josh Morrissey. I thought he was one of the key factors to this. And, you know, again, thank you, Bieksa. He pointed it out. Again, I don't think, obviously, Bieksa watches all the games, because Morrissey struggled this year. And we had highlighted that a few times throughout the season. But I thought throughout, even as, you know, notwithstanding his offensive contributions, but his stick, I thought in terms of just subtle little plays, they showed it on the replay where he was kind of turned around, the puck was about to go by him, and he just poked it to the corner and then followed whoever the Edmonton forward was, and then just ever so slightly jammed the puck alongside the boards, and then we had a breakout. Like, he did so many of those and blocking shots. I thought he was great, and I wanted to pick someone from our D-Corps because that's what we were worried about, right? And I thought they acquitted themselves very well, and I thought he was the best of the bunch, so he's my first-class pick.
Yeah, I thought he played really well. I think that's a really thoughtful choice. Do you want to go first with penalty box, or can I be the bad guy?
You go bad guy it up.
You do that, you go to the box, you know, 2 minutes by yourself, and you feel shame, you know, and then you get free.
All right, your friend and mine, Derek Forbort, goes into the penalty box. I thought he had, first and foremost, he had a very good fourth game, but there were more games to this series than simply the fourth game. I thought he did all those things that you mentioned previously in the fourth game, but I felt that there was a trend emerging that McDavid and others were clearly targeting him and gaining entry into our zone by attacking where he was. There was one game, it was game three, I counted three times in one period that McSwept went straight at Forbort and gained easy entrance into our zone. And also, he's in the penalty box because Keith Jones of NHL and NBC gave him the nickname Minus Forbort, which sums up his season nicely.
That's the best thing I've ever heard. I've got two shirts to make now. That is... Oh, I'm disappointed in us, Vaughn.
That we didn't come up with that?
That was sitting right there. I'm disappointed in us.
Well, he is a professional, and we're just getting started.
Yeah, so we got some room for improvement, though. That is great. I want to stipulate that, you know, I was praising him. You're right. It was primarily game four. But I didn't think that he was as out of place because he's a terrible matchup. You're talking about the fastest, most skilled player in the entire NHL, and we basically have a turtle back there. And so I don't disagree with that. I am going to reluctantly, and I know you're probably going to disagree to a certain extent, if I've got to put someone in the penalty box in a 4-0 sweep, it's PLD. I hope he gets there. But it's, you know, we talked about it. It's part snake bit, part, I think, maybe getting used to his teammates. And I don't know what happened. Those first couple games, he scored some OT winners.
Yeah.
He had some really impactful plays. He was making some smart passes. But every time, like, I got to the point where every time he touched the puck, especially on the power play, I was like, well, this is a turnover. Like, he's either going to fall or he's going to turn around the wrong way into an opponent. Like, I know he's a better hockey player than this, so I don't know what's going on. When he came back in game two, at the end of game two, I was like, meh. And then Ehlers obviously stole the show in game three. I look forward to maybe some improvement in round two, but it was something that I noticed throughout. Dude's having a rough one.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that. I feel that there's a large element to being snake bitten here. The one thing I will have, we have talked about him doing a lot of little things well and not a lot of big things. And it was his timely, you want to call it box out, you know, quasi interference on the Edmonton defender that helped open up the lane for Ehlers on his overtime goal in game three.
Yep.
So he did enough
Good point.
To open up the lane, not too much as to make it a penalty. So that's one of those little things that I think that he can bring to the table that Patrick Laine never could. And hopefully the bigger things will fall into place. You know, he looked, I think it was after that goal, he and Ehlers had a bit of a moment there in the group. They were jumping up and down. So hopefully his mindset remains positive and he can look past all of the things you're talking about, because you're right, he's struggling. And there is going to be some opportunity for him to step up and do big things going forward.
I agree.
When you mention Manitoba, I'll be mindful of the prairie.
From the people that brought you Manitoba's Spirited Energy campaign,
comes Manitoba's newest marketing sensation. Our Gateway to the West slogan taught the world that Manitoba is a convenient way to have access to better provinces. Friendly Manitoba told the world that despite consistently being the murder capital of Canada, when we're not murdering, we are really friendly. Manitoba's newest slogan is moving is expensive. If you currently reside in Manitoba, there's a 98% chance you were born in Manitoba. Let's embrace that, people. Let's face it, taking all of your shit and moving it is a pain in the ass. That's why we're here to remind Manitobans that moving is expensive. As a Manitoban, you're tired at the end of the day. Liquor marts don't rob themselves, and complaining about the premier is a full-time job. Truth be told, for 8 months of the year, it's too cold to go to the grocery store, let alone another province. So let's get apathetic, Manitobans. Why would you ever leave a province that is unironically proud to be the slurpy capital of North America? Manitoba, we've run out of ideas. All right, this brings us to trivia time, and you're not going to be shocked that this is playoff related, and I think you're probably going to get this because you already referenced part of the premise of this question, but in Winnipeg Jets totality, is this the Winnipeg Jets' first sweep?
Yes.
Okay. In non-NHL Winnipeg Jets history, is this the first Winnipeg Jets sweep? No,
I can't say that in 1974 the Jets swept the Indianapolis Pacers in a best of five. I can't say that, but I'm pretty confident that the WHA Jets would have swept someone in their time in the WHA.
And they sure did, 4-0 in the second round, and guess who it was?
Indianapolis Pacers?
The Edmonton Oilers.
Oh, wow.
Symmetry.
Wow.
And we ended up and I didn't realize this. I know we got, because I went to some of these games with my dad. Shout out to my dad.
Okay.
But 83, 84, 85, and 87, we got swept by the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah.
So this makes this sweet, sweet, sweet goodness.
Right.
And that's it. That's my trivia question. But it was like,
okay.
It was something where I was like, I went down to do it and I was like, ooh, man, there's some good symmetry here with sweeping in the Edmonton Oilers.
Well, mine is less romantic than yours. I'm chasing the corporate dollar here. So
it is.
I stuck with the that goddamn Steam trivia category, where just like Jets 1.0, you'll find that Thomas Steen might not be the answer. Okay, so again, this section of the trivia challenge is brought to you by First Mine and Gold, the first name in gold. Mike, did you know that First Mining Gold recently added over 1,600 hectares to their Springpole Gold project in northwestern Ontario? This is an exciting development for both exploration and investment interests alike.
I can't tell where this bit is going now. I can't tell if Dan is paying you on the side or if this is just a joke. Dan, if you're listening to this and you're giving Vaughn money, I want mine too. What the hell?
Okay. So, I would like to reiterate, this segment is fully endorsed, funded, sanctioned, and legally protected by President and CEO of First Mining Gold, Dan Wilton, our friend. Okay, so, in 2010, Thomas Steen won election to the Winnipeg City Council, where he represented the Elmwood East Kildonan ward for one term.
Oh my goodness.
Prior to his stint as a city councillor, Steen ran as a candidate in the 2008 federal election. Which party did he represent in that election? The 2008 federal election. Which party did Thomas Steen run under their banner?
I don't even know what he ran as. I don't know. I would guess conservative.
Correct.
Oh. The
Conservative Party.
Yeah.
He lost the election by 1,600 votes to longtime New Democrat Jim Malloway in the riding of Elmwood Transcona. He did receive a respectable 41% of the popular vote. This is where it gets good. During the election, Steen was criticized for being unfamiliar with the riding. He lived in South Winnipeg. He missed several debates.
And
he was criticized for reading from pre-prepared speaking notes at the debates he attended. One journalist noted Steen was radically out of his depth, muzzled by his party, and unfamiliar with the issues.
Kind of like me at work.
I've been described the same way, yes.
Well, the checkered history of having professional athletes and famous people run for political office, there is very few and far between where they're like, man, this person is sharp, and they really get the issues, and they're here for all the right reasons, so that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, there's more to quality decision making than name brand recognition, but we'll leave that for another time. Shall we move on to last call?
We shall.
Hey guys, just letting you know it's last call. Almost time to wrap it up.
All right, so we're at last call.
Yep.
The last call is going to be a very quick question. A bit of a different format today. We've sort of thrown the regular form out the window. We're quickly going to speak to the question or the statement that's out there a lot on social media. Was the Oilers Game 3 overtime goal the biggest goal in Jets 2.0 history? Mike, you go first.
I am going to succumb to recency bias because I'm going to say yes. Again, I know we had that deep playoff run in 2018, and I know there were a number of important goals within that. And quite frankly, if we make it into round three, I would be beyond elated. So I don't want to disregard the past. But this was something where I don't recall in any Jets 2.0 playoff game where we were this Anaheim. I know we didn't really have a chance, but that we ended up getting pounded 4-0. Like, I don't remember a scenario where national media, local media, we had all resigned ourselves to the fact that this probably wasn't going to happen. And I think that goal and just the circumstances around it, again, probably suffering from recency bias, but that would be, I would say yes.
You know, I'm inclined to agree. I think that recency bias is very strong here. You think back to that Game 7 against Nashville. There were some big goals in that game, but none stood out more so than the other. Like, I think in that game, Paul Stastny ended up getting the winner, but he didn't get the final one. Like, I think it was right. The goal by... it was the goal by Scheifele that really put the nail in the coffin. And I think when you win a seventh game in the second round, it should mean more than game three in the first round. But I'm going to agree with you and say this is the biggest goal in Jets 2.0 history. Because of the history and geography of the whole thing, I think it was the most important goal in the series. I do. I think it just edges out Stastny's goal, which was critical. Now, I know I described that one previously as, you know, tipping the balance in favor of the Jets. But I think once we go up 3-0, there's really no coming back from that. And I think that, you know, exercising all of the demons that...
I have exercised the demons.
...that comes with playing the Edmonton Oilers, and not just any Edmonton Oilers team. They had a Gretzky-like player on their team. They have a Messier-like player on their team.
Good point.
I do think that as big as the Connor 3 OT winner was, as big as the Stastny OT winner was, I do think this was the defining moment in that series. And I will say, I think sweeping the Oilers in the first round trumps beating Nashville in the second round. Second round, more important.
Yeah.
But it's not a Western Conference final or anything like that. So
that's a great comparison, because that was, because, you know, we had battled back and forth with them. They were sort of our nemesis. There was sort of skepticism that we were able to beat them in a 7-game series. But I agree with you. I do. I think this victory in this manner, to my mind, will always rank just a bit higher than that. Which, again, not to diminish that result in any way, shape, or form.
And I think what happens after this will help elevate or sort of...
good point.
Snap down or diminish in a way the historical importance of this goal. And we didn't get a chance this week to talk about... You know, we don't know who we're going to play. So why talk? Well, the Jets are going to play Toronto or they're going to play Montreal. Like, everyone knows that. I mean, we'll, on our next podcast, take a look at either both of those teams or one of those teams more closely.
Yeah.
But if we can go forward, and I think what we'll share in the next podcast is there are, you know, very workable paths forward to beat either one of those teams. They're not guaranteed. No. But it could happen. And I think that... if we can win another round or two, we will look back on that goal as the catalyst that helped get us there. You know, so it may grow, or if we go out in four to whoever in the next series, that it will be diminished. So I think it will be part of the living history of the Jets, but for right now, and we are still in the moment, it's the biggest goal.
Well said, sir.
All right. So, fellow travelers, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at Airport Lounge 55, on Facebook, even though we don't do anything there, and check us out on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and be sure to come back next week to the Airport Lounge, because the first round is always on us. Until then, go Jets go.
Nick swept.
Well done.